We've spoken so far about the first five Dibros, and now we're going to move on to the second group, the second five. So on the other side of the Luchais we have, just as on the first side of the Luchais, we have five commandments which are bein Adam Lamokim. They're between kinds of mitzvahs that join man to his creator. Now we're going to talk about five commandments which are the root commandments of all commandments that define the relationship between man and man. And we'll run through them real quickly. Lo sirtach, you shall not murder. Lo tinav, you shall not commit adultery. Lo tignav, you shall not steal. Lo sanav reacho et shaker, you shall not testify against your neighbor falsely. Lo sachmal beis reacho, you shall not covet the house of your friend. You shall not covet the wife of your friend, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, v'chol asher l'riyacha, or anything else which belongs to your friend. The Pesach Yigoin traces all of the Bein Adam L'Chaviro laws, all of the mitzvahs and all of the dinim that relate man to man, ultimately find their way back to these root laws, so that all of the mitzvahs, the one portion of the mitzvahs that relate man to God, and those that relate man to man, all find their way back to these roots. These are the 10 roots, and if you want to talk about even deeper roots, then they are the two mitzvos, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. All positive commandments go back to that. Lo yilech elohim acherim, shall not have any other gods before me. All negative commandments, all restrictive commandments go back to that. So that virtually every time a person violates one of the restrictive commandments, he is really, there's a nuance of idolatry involved. Every time a person fails to rise to fulfill one of the positive commandments, it's an insufficiency in his commitment to honor the sovereignty of the Almighty. So that's how those laws get traced back. Just for the sake of interest, there are seven mitzvos which the Chachamim added. They are of rabbinic origin, such as Purim and Chanukah. Anyway, there are seven mitzvos which the Chachamim added, and if you add those seven mitzvos to the 613, there's a total of 620 mitzvos, 613 of which are of Torah origin, and another seven which the Chachamim decreed. If you wanted to take the time to begin counting from the very first letter of the Ten Commandments to the very last letter of the Ten Commandments, you would find 620 letters. Which, if you were to count from the very first letter of the Aseres HaDibros, from the very first word, Anochi, in other words, you were to start from the Aleph of Anochi, and you were to go up to the Chaf of this last Dibur, V'chol Asher L'Reyecha, you would count a total of 620 letters. Because all of the 613 commandments, all of the mitzvos, derive from the Aseres HaDibros. The last seven letters make up the word Asher L'Reyecha, which are to your friend. Those relate to the seven mitzvos d'Rabbanan. Those are Asher L'Reyecha. Those last seven commandments belong to your friend, meaning they belong to, their origin is man rather than the Almighty. In any event, and we can talk about some of the derivations of many of the mitzvahs. For example, Lashon Hara, we said this, I think we've spoken about this before, maligning someone, slandering somebody, is really a derivation of the mitzvah, thou shalt not murder. It's a form of murder. And there are many, many such derivations of each mitzvah. When the Aseres HaDibros are read privately, then you pronounce the first of these last five commandments. You would say, Lo Sir Tzach. The Nikud, the vowel, is a patach. When you read it publicly, in other words, when you read it in the synagogue for the congregation, then you read it Lo Tirtzach with a comment. So there are two very interesting commentaries on the fact that this Nikud changes. One commentary suggests the following. The Gemara tells us, drawing on two psukim, two verses in scriptures, that when a situation calls for a psak, it calls for someone to give a definitive direction. What is one to do? Is this kosher? Is it treif? Is it mutar or is it osur? Is it allowable or is it prohibitive? Are you chayiv or are you putter? Are you obligated to pay or to do, or are you free of doing? In other words, any of the questions that one would submit to someone who has the knowledge, so that person would be able to give you what the Das Torah is, what the Torah's directive would be. So that the Talmud tells us that there are two sides of one coin. One side of the coin is somebody who doesn't know. He doesn't really have the necessary information, but he presents himself as an authority. That person, the Gemara tells us, is guilty of destroying many lives, because inasmuch as he really does not have the requisite knowledge to decide these questions and parades as though he were an authority, as though he was knowledgeable, he is in fact misinforming, misdirecting, and there are people who trust his opinion, and they go on and do things which are in fact counterproductive. So he is guilty of destroying many lives. On the other hand, the Gemara uses yet another verse to describe the kind of devastation which is the product of somebody who does know the answers, but because they don't want to push themselves, because they don't want to stand out, so they sit silently by and allow a situation to go either misinformed or with no direction, just for something to kind of roll with absolutely no clarity. So we find that there's a very fine line here. Somebody who doesn't know is guilty of all kinds of destruction by posturing as someone who does know. Someone who does know is guilty of all kinds of destruction if he refuses to stand up and do what's necessary. That's misplaced humility. And God knows what else. The words that describe the vowels, the A sound, is called the Patach, which literally means from the word Pesach, to open up. The word Kamatz represents the A sound, and that literally means to close up. So Lo Sirtzach has two forms. There are two forms of murder. There's one form of murder through the Patach, by opening your mouth when you have no right to. There's another form of murder that takes place when you're Lo Tirtzach, when it's a Kamatz, when you close your mouth, when you should in fact speak up. So there's a very fine line, and everybody walks it at any given time, because it's not only the leading halachic authority that has to take this into account. Every person in a community, every person in a situation has certain knowledge which could bring clarity, which could bring some direction to a confusion. And many of us shrink back. We don't want to, we don't want somebody to point a finger at us and say, look, this is the frummy, and this is the know-it-all, and this is the guy who's always pushing himself. So we're silent when we should speak. And we have to understand that that's a sin of omission. We're guilty of a very destructive silence. On the other hand, we also need to know our limitations. We need to know when we don't know. There's yet another variation on this same question, and that goes back to the issue of the different ways in which a person can be guilty of murder. There's one form of murder which is called shvichus damim. Literally, you spill somebody's blood. You stab them, you beat them, you shoot them, whatever. However it is that this person loses his life. There's another form of murder which our sages describe also by the term shvichus damim, except it doesn't take place by spilling blood outside the body. It takes place when you humiliate somebody or you embarrass them, and the blood drains from their face or rushes to their face. It's a form of spilling blood. And once again, these two terms come into play. There's a form of lo sirtzach with a patach, where you open a wound in the person's body and you kill him, you spill his blood. That's lo sirtzach, patach. But there's a form of lo sirtzach, kamatz, where there is no spilling of blood. It's all closed. All the blood takes place inside. All the spilling of blood takes place inside closed quarters, within the person themselves. And that too is murder. So embarrassing or humiliating a person, shaming a person, also falls under the category of murder. One person said, it goes back to what we learn in Parshas Noach, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam. You spill the blood of man within man.
I wanted to ask you about your previous comment. If you live within a society which is founded and operates on Torah, for example, like we see in Jerusalem, then somebody who knows in that particular kind of things is always surrounded by people who care. There are some times when he offends people, but at least within the situation in which he lives, feels open to point out to everybody things that are very wrong. It seems to me that that in the context of the rest of the world, in 14 seconds, somebody who did that would be totally isolated. I mean, you would be walking around all the time like a destructive force. So how do we put that in context by saying that people who do that have to have a motive, or they have to have a goal, or that they have to put themselves in a situation where they're not in that situation? How would somebody exist in the regular Jewish community today if every time they saw something, most of the things that we see are incorrect?
You know, that Sefer that you brought me has a whole chapter on on what our obligations are in different situations where people are not likely to welcome what we have to say. And those are pretty complex guidelines. I was looking at it when we were flying back from New York, and I'm still not convinced that I understand exactly when there's an obligation to stand up and do your thing, even to the point of inviting people to come at you with baseball bats. And where is the situation in which, understanding that you're not likely to be heard, that you don't say anything. But I would say, by the way, that in a great many instances, it seems to me that much of the question, anyway, a fair portion of the question, is traceable to how it's done. There are people who do it in ways that are obnoxious, and there are people who do it in ways which people can listen to it. And if somebody develops a sense of how to transmit a message in a very respectful way, so that it doesn't demean people and doesn't put them down and allows them some dignity of trying to do the right thing, I think that there are many more instances of a person being effective than we allow for. I think there are a lot of situations in which we could be. I don't speak about myself. I know that there are a good many situations that I probably should respond to and don't.
I feel that that's definitely true, particularly for the lay people, because it seems to me it's slightly less threatening for lay people to come and do things other than for rabbis. When a rabbi comes and does it already, it's got a, you know, big authority with it. When lay people do it, it has, you know, not quite as threatening.
It's less
threatening. But I think that is a major problem we have in the community, is that people don't do this enough. And we don't know exactly, because hopefully much of it is done in a private way. But I think that's a very important problem, that people, like the story of the everyone who's supposed to bring the wine to the wedding, everybody brings water, mm-hmm. Everybody assumes, well, it's not their job. It's a terrible problem in the community, and that's why we do, as a community, drift so much. But I just wanted to say one thing on another, just on that point, though, Rabbi. We talk about publicly embarrassing people, but when we tell somebody, and I believe we should do this, but when we tell somebody, I just want you to know, by the way, my friend, is that when I was at that meeting last week and you said such and such, you know, it was incorrect. And the same kind of blood situation can occur,
right,
even though you aren't saying it in front of those 15 people. You're only saying it to them personally. You know, if they're the right kind of people, they're probably still, you know, terribly, terribly embarrassed. So it seems to me there's a question of being helpful to somebody, and still, even when you're being helpful and doing it in the right way, you're still,
right,
going to cause the same.
All right, you can embarrass somebody privately too. It's not just much more.
Well, now they're embarrassed not privately to you. They're now embarrassed publicly in front of those people, because you've now told them of what they did in front of those people. So now.
So they're retroactively embarrassed.
They're retroactively embarrassed.
Yeah, but I want to tell you that even in your presence,
people, they're going to feel, oh, what did I do in front of them?
Yeah. Right, you know, and it is an art form. There's no question about the fact that admonishing somebody or giving somebody direction is a very delicate, very delicate skill.
But this is, let's say I'm all this thing of Arab around me.
Yeah, but you can shame somebody privately.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not the same severity.
But nonetheless, losi salam khayt. I mean, you have to do it in a way in which you're not going to aggravate the situation or bring the person to hate you because you've done it.
But the mere telling of something of somebody, even in the finest way, can seriously embarrass them.
Good. There's another comment over here by the Kliyoko. approaches this from one of the standpoints that we were talking about in some of our earlier sessions, where we spoke about the fact that the Zohar tells us that there are all kinds of interrelationships between the Dibreis, that, for example, each one of the commandments is connected to the commandments which follow it in a certain sequential way, but also that there is a correspondence and a certain parallelism between the Dibros that are next to one another, so that I am the Lord your God, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, has a direct relationship with the Dibur Lo Sirtzach, thou shalt not murder. And thou shalt not lo yilecha l'machirim, shall have no other gods, has a direct relationship with thou shalt not commit adultery. And we can see how some of those things run. So that the entertaining of other gods is a form of adultery. It's an infidelity to the Almighty. Similarly, to the extent that a human being is created in the image of God, to murder a person, it really speaks to the fact that you don't recognize that he bears the image of God in his person, and you deal with him as though he were just a thing, an animal, something that does not have anything sacred or godly about them, and can be erased for whatever suits your purposes. I may be over here extending the Kli Yoker a bit, but he draws upon this well-known Medrash, Tegmura Medrash, that before God gave the Torah to the Jewish people, that he went around and tried to broker it to the nations of the world. So he came to Edom, to Esau, and he asked Edom, would you accept the Torah? And Edom asked, what's written in it? And he said, and God answered, it says, thou shalt not murder. So Edom responded, well, my blessing is Al-Chabcha Tichya. Jacob blessed our forefather, our nation, that we're to live by the sword. So we can't accept the Torah because it's a contradiction to the what makes us tick. And so it was with the Bnei Yishmael, and so it was with the other nations. Everybody found something, whether it was thou shalt not steal or thou shalt not commit adultery. There was each nation found some objection. What Kli Yoker seems to be implying is, and in reality, the part of this is supported by the Maharal, that this discussion was not really in the form of a conversation. God coming to the nation saying, will you accept the Torah? And they're answering, only if you tell us what's in it, and we can judge whether or not we want it. And then tells them, well, it says you shall not murder, and they then respond, well, then we don't want it. That in effect, that this dialogue is an implied dialogue. In other words, that God, as it were, tested the personality, the character of each nation to see whether or not the nation was capable of living up to the Torah. And when he tested the character of Edom, a nation who was prone to violence, he saw that this nation was incapable of being able to deal responsibly with thou shalt not murder. One of the seven Noahide laws is the law of murder. So, and by the way, it happens to be, interestingly enough, it is a law which is in some ways more severe than the laws of murder as they pertain to Jews, for example. Although abortion is prohibited by Jewish law, but it is not a capital offense. A Jewish person performing, or a Jewish doctor performing an abortion, is not guilty of murder. It's very, very serious business, but it is not, he cannot be put to death for it. In other words, the Jewish courts do execute for murder. You cannot execute a person for an abortion. You would be subject to a heavenly punishment of death, but not to a human court. Whereas, in the Noahide laws, a non-Jew who performs an abortion violates the law of Lo Sirtza, of thou shalt not murder. One of the interesting ramifications of that is that if a Jewish woman were halachically to have a situation that allowed for an abortion, she would not be permitted to take that abortion to a non-Jewish doctor. Right, because the non-Jewish doctor would be guilty of murder. He does not have the liberty of intervening in that situation. So in some ways the Lo Sirtzach of the non-Jew reaches even further, or has much severe qualities about ramification. Now, one of the implications of what the Kli Yoker seems to be saying is that to the extent that man is created in the image of God, that he is fully accountable, fully responsible, that his capacity to choose freely is a given characteristic of his essence. And that for somebody to say, I couldn't help myself, is not a defense. And for somebody to say, I was in this terrible rage, and because I was in this terrible rage, I blew this guy away. That may sell, for whatever it's worth, in some civil court. And the list of reasons for which a person will not be guilty of murder can make a person dizzy. And we've come up with all kinds of gradations of insanity that allow the courts a latitude that sometimes really offends us. But the point is that there is a dignity with which we attribute to a human being. There is a sense of the resources and the strength that every person can depend to. And one of the things that he sees taking place in this dialogue between Esav and God when he goes around trying to sell the Torah is that Esav is saying, you know what, I just have this violent disposition and I can't help myself. And the Almighty is saying, then if that makes sense to you, if you believe that there is that this is an excuse, that you can rationalize your conduct by saying, I can't help myself, then you cannot be a bearer of Torah. Only the nation, Klal Yisrael, that said, there are probably many, many things here that are very difficult for us. But we recognize the inherent dignity and accountability and responsibility of every Jew, and therefore, as difficult as it may be, as impossible as it may seem at times, we accept the Torah. Nasa Vinishma, anything and everything. It's only a nation that recognizes that it is responsible and capable, that has any business accepting the Torah. And that's a direct product of a parallel between Anechi Hashem Lekiach, I am Hashem, your God, which also tells us not only that we are responsible to God, but that there is something of Hashem himself within us. And that that quality of our being the bearers of this divine spark makes us responsible, so that we are obligated to answer to every form of Osirzach. Between the first set of Dibreis and the last set of Dibreis, there are some conspicuous differences. We've already treated or discussed one of them. For example, the fact that in the first text here in Yisrael, it says, Zachiris Yom HaShabbos L'Kadshei, you shall remember, and in the second text, for the second Luchais, which we find in Parshas Vaschanan in the book of Devarim, there it says, Shamoris Yom HaShabbos L'Kadshei, you shall guard, observe, as opposed to remember. An interesting difference is also finds its way into these last five Dibreis. In the first, you will notice in the Hebrew text that each one of these is stated independently. Lo tirzach, lo tinov, lo tinov. Each one is an independent statement unto itself. Whereas in Parshas Vaschanan, it's written lo tirzach, v'lo tinov, v'lo tinov. In other words, there's a vav that's added to each one of these thou shalt not. Instead of saying thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, it's thou shalt not, and thou shalt not, and thou shalt not, and thou shalt not. So that vav is a matter of some interest. Both the Maral and the Ostrovitz Rebbe, it's curious to me that the Ostrovitz Rebbe does not relate to this Maral, because he was a tremendous genius. They explain the distinction in the following way. They say that at the time that the first Luchais were given, Klal Yisrael had ascended, that they had raised themselves to such a high spiritual level that even if it were to come to pass that someone would violate one of these commandments, that they would be violating a discrete category. In other words, it would not unravel their entire being. It would affect a certain dimension of their spiritual being, but it would not completely unravel them. Whereas the second Luchais, which you remember came into being after they had worshipped the golden calf, and they had fallen from the level which they had attained prior to the first Luchais, their vulnerability to evil was much greater. In general, their level of clarity in right and wrong was severely compromised. And the result is that you'll remember that our Chazal tell us that Avera Goreris Avera, one sin draws one to do another one. In other words, there's a certain momentum which is built up. A person does something wrong, it affects them in such a way that they are now much more prone to do something else wrong. They're in a negative place. And one avera drags another one completely across the discrete category in which that person violated whatever he did. So for a person, for example, were to do something which would be a violation of, let's say, Lashon Hara, he might find himself very vulnerable in an area that would have to do with the integrity of their morality in business, or the integrity of the morality between himself and the members of the opposite gender. In other words, it's not a discrete effect. The consequences of doing an avera today are that the entire person becomes inclined and approached to all of this from Maimar and Shavuos from Rav Gedalia Shor. Gedalia Shor discusses some of the differences between the first and the second luchais. And he draws upon the fact that the first luchais, both the writing on the luchais and the substance upon which that writing was inscribed, were both of a heavenly stuff. Whatever it was that these luchais were made of, the first luchais did not come from any material that was recognizable as having come of a physical origin. They were not physical. And we're told all kinds of wondrous things about those luchos, that the words shine through from one side to the next. And what's more, in our experience, when letters shine through one side to the next, the person on the other side will see them in the reverse. But these shine through in such a way that each side saw them in the right order, so that they were legible from every angle. Those were the first luchais. The second luchais, Hashem instructs Moshe that he should take out of a quarry right underneath his tent. There was a quarry that he should hew the stone for the luchais, and he should bring up the stone to Har Sinai, and there Hashem would write the very same words. So the words were the same, but the material was different. The material now was a physical material. It was a material of this world. And consequently, the effect of the letters on the material was not the same as it was on the first luchos. He goes on to say that corresponded directly to what had happened to the Jewish people themselves. We find that our sages describe the spiritual status of Klal Yisrael before the giving of the Torah to have been that of Adam before he committed his sin. In other words, they had risen to such a level that they were now in the same kind of state that Adam was before he ate of the tree of knowledge, which was a wondrous state. And that by participating in whichever way, because the vast majority, almost the entirety of Klal Yisrael, was only guilty of complicity in the Chet Egel by their silence, by the fact that they didn't protest. There was only a very small fraction of a percentage that actually sinned with the Egel, but regardless, by their complicity in the Egel, that they then once again found themselves in the same fallen state that was characteristic of man after having eaten from the tree of knowledge. One of the points of reference for that is that it says that Hashem made for Vayas Lakim Adam Kostnas Or, that God made for man. Let's see how that works. Right there. Hashem la'odam al-ishtay, and Hashem, God, made for man and his wife garments of leather, vayalbishem, and he clothed them. Now the word over here, which means leather, is the word or, skin, leather, hide. The same word, or if you transpose instead of the ayin, you put in an aleph, then it's the word light. And our sages in the Sfar Meditation point out that initially, that the body of Adam was not of a physical variety at all. Adam did not really belong to the physical world in the same way that the animals belong to the physical world. That Adam's body, his goof, you would have described as his physical being, was in fact a being of light. That man, before he sinned, was an entity of light. And his neshama was of such an elevated status that it was an even loftier light. And it wasn't until he ate of the tree of knowledge that this body of light became a body of leather, became a body of skin, of oil. In any event, to the extent that Klal Yisrael had moved to this chet status, so the luchos that they were given corresponded to where they were at, just as they had restored or had returned to a state in which they had once again transposed the ayin back into an aleph, and the bodies, as it were bodies of light. So also were the luchos such that the soul of the luchos, the writing, was invested in the body of the luchos, which was of some unworldly, otherworldly stuff. So the luchos had a soul and a body. The body was whatever it was written on, and the soul were the words. We find, by the way, that the Gemara tells us that if a person should be in the proximity of someone who dies, that they should tear their clothes, even though they're not an immediate relative of the deceased, that they should rend their clothes, just as they would rend their clothes if they were to be in a room where somebody tore a Sefer Torah or scraped off the letters of a Sefer Torah. In other words, just as somebody who would desecrate a Sefer Torah, and in the presence of that desecration, someone would be obligated to tear their clothes, in much the same way if someone is in the presence of somebody who dies. The same thing is happening. The letters
are the neshama
of the parchment. The soul is the neshama of the body. And the body is like the parchment. And the soul is like the writing. So the luchos corresponded to where Israel was at. Israel at that time had reached this priest chet condition, status, and therefore the luchos corresponded to them. There was a body of light, there was a body of some heavenly stuff, and upon that, the soul, the writing was inscribed.
Is there a correspondence between the chet of Adam and the chet of Eliyahu?
I think so. That's probably one of the best ways to explain it. Having committed the cheta ego, they were once again back with kasnais ayah, with an ayin. They were back now where their bodies of light had once again been exchanged for a body of physical body, a body of skin and flesh. And therefore, the luchais which they received were luchais in which the physical stuff had to be provided from the earth. They had to be provided from this worldly material. But the soul was still the same. The soul, the writing of those luchais was still the same. So he says, for example, the first, when Klal Yisrael first received the Aseres HaDibros in their state in which they and the luchais were both, as it were, light upon light. He says the effect of that is that there is such a dynamic flow, such an interchange between the soul, as it were, and this translucent body, that the body was not an obstruction to the soul. Our bodies are an obstruction to the soul. They get in our way. There's a tension between our body and our souls. And our souls want one thing, and the body does not allow the light to flow through. It also obscures the capacity of the neshama to be as effective as it might otherwise be, because our bodies have an independent agenda of their own. So in that state, where there was this very dynamic relationship between the writing and the luchais, there was that same dynamic relationship between the soul of man and whatever constituted their bodies. To that extent, when Hashem, for example, spoke the dibul relating to Shabbos, the consciousness of each person in their relationship to Shabbos is that they were intensely, totally aware of Shabbos. So when the Shabbos came, they were in a constant state of zachor. Every moment they remembered, they were in constant contact with the Shabbos, because there was nothing to obscure the light of Shabbos from flowing freely between the soul of man and the source of Shabbos. So a person was in a constant state of awareness. It was absolutely meaningless at that point to use the word shamor. You know, be careful, don't violate the Shabbos, because man was in a constant state of awareness. And being always aware of Shabbos, there was no reason to have to say to him, listen, don't do this, or don't do the other thing, because you're going to desecrate the Shabbos. There was no inclination at all to ever be drawn in that direction, because man was always engaged with the Shabbos. It wasn't until there was now this duality. One of the spokesmen for Klal Yisrael said today, the dialectic, he calls it, the dialectic of the body and the soul, that there was this dual tension now, that now you have to say to man was no longer on the inside looking out. He was now on the outside looking in. There was this neshama that was trying to record itself on, engrave itself on the body of the stone, something which was resistant to the writing. So now we have to say to the individual, we have to say to him, Shamar, you know, you're not always mindful. You're not always remembering that it's Shabbos, because there are many times that you're remembering other things that have nothing at all to do with Shabbos. So now we have to tell you, be very careful, Shamar. He says the same thing is true that of the way in which we absorb any of the halachs. For example, there's this very wonderful comment on this. The verse in Kriyat Shema says, and And all of these words that I command you this day shall be alav avecha, shall be upon your heart. Because the question says, what do you mean they should be on your heart? They should be in your heart. What do you mean on your heart? So the answer to that, one of the answers is given, is that we have to recognize, we have to accept the fact that our hearts are not always absorbent. They're not always open. They're not always ready to receive. And to that extent, we might say, well, I'm not really open to this right now, so what's the point of my learning, or what's the point of my listening, or what's the point of my doing? It's not going to happen. I'm impervious to this message. To that extent, the Torah is telling us, just do it. Fill up a couple stories of mitzvahs, of good deeds, of wisdom, of Torah knowledge. There will come a time, sometime, when your heart will open. And when your heart opens, if you've got lots of stuff piled on top, it will go in. If there's nothing there, then when your heart opens, it will have nothing to receive. Gedal Yeshua suggests over here that the nature of all of these laws, when they were given the first time, in other words, according to the first state, is that they immediately became part of the person themselves. They were immediately absorbed into the organism. When Hashem said Lo Tinov, Lo Signov, Lo Sirtov, whatever He said, that they immediately were absorbed because they were not opaque, they were not impervious to the message. So immediately became part of them. And when Hashem spoke the next law, it too was totally absorbed and became an inseparable, indivisible part of that essence. So there was no point at all, there was no necessity to have to put in the Vav, which is a connective letter, because they were not artificially connected, they were organically connected. The second time, when they were impervious, here, these laws were not absorbed one into the other as they would in a totally fluid medium. These were kind of from the outside working their way in, and in that state, they connected in not in the same organic way, but in an arithmetic way. Here's this law, and there's this law, but they connected and related to the person and to one another in a way which was respectful of the change that had taken place in Klal Yisrael. So on the second Dibros, there had to be a Vav, whereas in the first Dibros, the Vav was unnecessary.